This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. A few days before the end of 1973, then-President Richard Nixon signed the Bipartisan Endangered Species Act. It was unanimously passed in Congress by a vote of 92-0 in the Senate and 355-4 in the House. The Endangered Species Act was created as a way to prevent endangered and threatened species from becoming extinct and protecting their natural habitats as well. 45 years later, the Donald Trump administration, along with some members of Congress, have been proposing sweeping reforms they say would modernize the act and cut back on government red tape that supporters say stymies the U.S. economy. The proposed changes would uphold President Trump's pledge to cut U.S. government regulations and follow an executive order that said that for every new regulation, two need to be relaxed or tossed out. Today, we'll discuss the U.S. Endangered Species Act and efforts to roll back some of its provisions that protect endangered species. My guests today are Ingrid Segerman, senior legislative analyst of Defenders of Wildlife, an advocacy organization that focuses on wildlife and habitat conservation in the U.S. And we're also joined by Darren Baxt, senior research fellow in agriculture policy at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative public policy think tank based here in Washington, D.C. They both join me at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
It's great to be here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ingrid, could you give us a brief overview of the history of the Endangered Species Act?
Sure. Well, as you said, this is an enormously popular bill that was passed with tremendous bipartisan support back in 1973. And it still remains a very successful and popular conservation law, which has prevented many U.S. and foreign species from going extinct. And fewer than 1% of species that have been listed under the law have gone extinct. We consider that a great success rate. And according to a 2015 poll, 90% of American voters support the Endangered Species Act. And it is very effective, and it affords species that come under the protections of the act certain protections, such as prohibiting harm to them and also restraining certain government activities that could cause that species to be jeopardized or adversely affect critical habitat. And we think this is a really visionary law. It came to pass when we saw species declining due to unmitigated use of dangerous pesticides like DDT, which was killing off bald eagles and other birds, nearly causing their extinction. And the ESA has saved the bald eagle, as well as other species like the American alligator and the brown pelican, from extinction.
Darren, as I noted in my opening, the act passed back in 1973 with an incredible bipartisan support. What has happened to change that?
Well, I just want to stress that protecting endangered species and threatened species both in the United States and globally is a critical objective. But that's not the same thing as protecting the Endangered Species Act. For the last 45 years, the law simply hasn't worked. There are 1,661 domestic species and 678 foreign species on the endangered species list. Only 54 have been recovered. There's about 31 or so that actually have been delisted off that list because they became extinct or because of technical errors. As Senator Barrasso from Wyoming said, and he's a doctor, he says, as a doctor, if I had admitted 100 patients to the hospital and only three recover, enough under my treatment to be discharged, I would deserve to lose my medical license. And he's right. And I think if we care about endangered and threatened species, we need to be open to new ways to achieve those objectives, how to have success, to look at outcomes and make sure that we're achieving those outcomes. And one way is for the federal government to work collaboratively with the states. It's also very important for the federal government to work collaboratively with property owners. What's happened is that the law has created some type of fighting between the federal government and property owners. And we're talking about farmers, ranchers, and not just businesses, but also just family that wants to build their dream house on some property that they purchased decades ago. And then they find out they can't do what they wanted to on their land through no fault of their own. And that doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't protect the species, and it certainly doesn't protect property rights or help the citizens.
Ingrid, has the act changed over the years, or has it remained intact as it was passed back in 1973?
It has changed. It's not a static law. It's not exactly the same law that was passed back in 1973. There have been amendments that have improved the law, as well as some changes in administrative implementation of the law that have improved it and made it more flexible over the years. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that while it's a strong law that prohibits harm to endangered species and does so by prohibiting certain actions, it's also flexible and it provides mechanisms for the government and private individuals to take or harm a limited number of protected species. It also rewards proactive conservation efforts. Those are some of the changes that have occurred over the years. For example, it has some incentives-based programs like safe harbor agreements. That's a voluntary agreement that allows landowners to enhance the habitat of listed species on their properties. In return, they'll receive assurances that they won't be required to take any additional conservation measures, and they won't face restrictions on activities that result in incidental take. So that's a pretty generous agreement for that landowner, and property owners are motivated to enter into those agreements because they do want to conserve species that are facing extinction, could be wiped off the face of the planet.
Darren, Ingrid brings up the flexibility of the act. I understand that's part of the criticism about the Endangered Species Act, is that it's very rigid and doesn't allow room to move.
Yeah, what's interesting is a lot of the reform bills that are being talked about, or even provisions, are so minor in scope, there really isn't that anything too significant. And that's unfortunate. I just want to point out that when we talk about, mention that 1% of the species have not become extinct, but that's a horrible measure of success. I mean, the law is designed to recover species. If our objective is just to make sure species don't become extinct, then policy decisions should be developed in that manner. But that would be horrible. We won't want to kind of make our goal, let's just make sure the species don't become extinct. If that was the case, then it would be pretty easy to kind of develop policies to do that. I mean, we should be shooting for much higher to protect these species. And I think there are some bigger questions that come into play. If society has decided that it's important to protect species, then society as a whole should be the one paying for the protection of the species. What happens is the costs of these protections get borne by property owners who have done nothing wrong whatsoever. This is not a pollute or pay type of situation. And they're bearing the costs. They may not technically lose their land, but they're losing the ability to use their land. And the value of the properties are going way down. So they're getting harmed. And we're talking about ordinary Americans getting slammed by this law. So really what we should have is less of a regulatory scheme per se, and actually identify how much money, and have like an appropriated program where we decide how much money does society, do the American taxpayers want to spend to achieve these objectives. That way it can be a transparent process, and I think we'd have a lot more success.
Ingrid, you look like you want to respond.
I do want to respond. Thank you. So the Endangered Species Act does afford this protection to species that are facing the threat of extinction by prohibiting what's called take. I mentioned it before, meaning you can't kill that species or harm it, including by harming a species by destroying its habitat. But that doesn't cover hypothetical harm, like simply landowner cutting down their tree that a bird may later nest in. There has to be evidence of actual harm done to a protected animal. And private individuals are very rarely prosecuted for actions that violate the Endangered Species Act if they're just carrying out regular activities on their land that do not require a federal permit from the government. So it's just very rare that there would be a prosecution in the first place. And when a planned action will certainly result in take and harm, there are, as I mentioned, mechanisms available under the Act that allow for limited harm to that species.
Darren, I understand that part of the revisions or proposed revisions to the Act would include a stipulation that consideration of economic impact would also need to be considered along with environmental and wildlife considerations.
Yeah, before I get to that, I just want to point out that for property owners, the fact that they're not criminally prosecuted too often is not too comforting to them. The fact that there's criminal elements to this law as it is pretty questionable. And there's also significant civil penalties as well.
Can you elaborate on that? What kind of criminal penalties or civil penalties?
Federal government certainly can bring cases against property owners with, and same thing with civil fines, and it can be pretty excessive. On the economic issue that you brought up, we should want to establish listings purely on science, but... And then we should draw a clear line between that and then any other ESA type of action, any type of determining take, critical habitat, that should be considered with economic factors. The problem is that the economic considerations in some situations, especially critical habitat, have been set up in a way so that the cost-benefit analysis and the cost are not really being properly taken into account. And there's so little data and information on what the impact is to property owners and how their value of their property is coming down. What kind of harm is imposed when major critical infrastructure projects are not developed for many years because, you know, they're not able to get the permits. There's a community in Montana who for 10 years are trying to get critical irrigation projects created, and they're very dependent on those projects, and they couldn't get it done. They finally, I think, were able to get the permit. I mean, it's very critical to protect species, but we can't simply ignore the basic needs of humans to be able to meet, to get clean water, to have safe and affordable energy. So there's many things also that go into figuring out what's best, not only to protect species, but also for humans.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Connect with us by email at encounter@voanews.com or check out our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA. Today, we're talking about the U.S. Endangered Species Act and efforts to roll back some of its provisions. My guests are Ingrid Segerman, a senior legislative analyst of the Defenders of Wildlife, an advocacy organization that focuses on wildlife and habitat conservation in the U.S. We're also joined by Darren Baxt, senior research fellow in the agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative public policy think tank based here in Washington, D.C. And right before we went to the break, Darren, you mentioned about that we need to consider the science aspects of the Endangered Species Act, that science must be considered. What do you sent the letter that 1,500 scientists sent to Congress to ask them to uphold the scientific foundations of the Endangered Species Act? They say that decisions relating to listings and management of species should be free from political interference.
As I was saying before, I think it is very important to draw the distinction between the listing and then any other action that's triggered as part of the ESA. So yes, to the extent that it can be as independent as possible, and it's pretty difficult, quite honestly, then that should be done. And we need to have sound science to do that. I think the problem is that it's important to distinguish between scientific decisions and policy decisions. Science can tell us very kind of objective answers to objective questions. When there are questions that even remotely impact policy, science does not provide us the answer. Those ultimately become policy questions and also economic questions. And what's really a problem with the ESA right now is, first of all, it's difficult to even know how much of a particular species even exists at any given time. But as one of my colleagues reported recently and did an analysis, a lot of the species that are deemed to be recovered were actually not recovered at all. In fact, if you looked at the data, the Fish and Wildlife Service and some of the agencies would point to say, you know, there was maybe like 7 plants, for example. Then it turns out there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of plants. And it's not because anything happened in terms of the recovery, but just because it was data error. And while the government does identify data error sometimes, many times there's plenty of examples have been identified where they'll say something's a recovery when in fact it was just a mistake in the first place. And we need to have a more transparent process, including with the science and the data, to be able to get the public and other experts to be involved in this process.
Ingrid, could you bring us up to date on the standards for determining what species are endangered? I believe it's endangered and threatened, two different categories. What is the process involved, and does policy play a role?
I would like to agree with something that Darren said, that it's very important that at the point of listing a species, it's of utmost importance that we use science to determine whether or not a species is endangered, meaning it's facing extinction imminently, or threatened, meaning that it could become an endangered species in the foreseeable future. It's really important that at that point we use science, which Darren agreed with. But unfortunately, we're seeing attacks from Congress that would do just the opposite, that would inject economic considerations into that decision at the time of listing. And that really goes against what the Endangered Species Act purposes. You know, we have this conservation ethic to ensure that there is biodiversity, that we don't let species go extinct on our watch. And it's just absolutely critical that we look at the best available science, which is what the Endangered Species Act requires, to make that decision at the time of listing.
Can I just jump in? I mean, at the time of listing, it's one thing if you're using the science for the specific, figuring out the actual listing, but at the time of listing, other things kind of trigger as well under the Act. And those other things like take and other issues, the economic factors do need to be considered at that time.
Well, one example I could mention of when economics do come into play is when the agencies designate critical habitat. And actually, they are already allowed to consider other factors, including what the economic impact would be of that critical habitat designation. So the ESA already provides for those types of considerations. But, you know, science should be upheld, and we're really facing a lot of attacks on science from Congress, whether it's interfering with listing decisions or interfering with other aspect of how the two federal wildlife agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, implement the Endangered Species Act.
So again, I'm really curious about how these species are selected to be put on the list of either endangered or threatened. What process, what benchmarks are used?
Scientists at the agencies are looking at the status of the species. They're looking at the distribution, the range of the species, and then they're also looking at what threats the species is facing. And then, you know, weighing all those factors against each other to determine whether the species needs federal protections generally at that time, and then what level of protections to provide. And I think it's important to remember that these are species that were all protected by the various states where they reside up until the point where they declined to the point where they need Endangered Species Act protections. And sometimes, unfortunately, they've declined so much under the state's watch that, you know, it's not recovery, conservation is not a magic wand. So Darren talked a little bit about how not as many species as we would like have recovered to the point of being delisted, and some have, but it's not a magic wand. It does take time, and the agencies need more funding to be able to create recovery plans and bring these species back from the brink of extinction to the point where they're doing well enough so that they don't require these important federal protections. So the agencies need to be funded. And for example, I think only half of currently listed species even have recovery plans.
Comments, Darren?
Yeah, there's a lot of comments. First of all, I think it's important to know that this idea that Congress is meddling in the science or somehow interfering with the agencies. Well, ultimately, Congress is the lawmaking body. If they make certain decisions as to whether or not something should be listed or not, or wants to change the process and try to make things more transparent, to try to expedite the process, to respect states a lot more than what the ESA does right now, then that certainly makes sense. And I think one of the problems is that there's this kind of philosophical belief by some that really the only way to solve these problems is for the federal government to do so and not to respect the states. I don't know why there's so much disrespect for the states. But if we're going to have success, there needs to be a true partnership between the federal government and the states. And actually, the states are closer to these issues. They know the issues better, and so do the property owners as well. Allow them to come up with creative and innovative solutions. Those are solutions that can help, that we can apply in other situations as well. They're like best practices. And those best practices can also apply and help other countries as they face challenges that are similar. Now, on the determining on what species should be listed, I think one of the challenges, one of the problems, is that it's kind of random in many ways. And by having more of an appropriated program, as I talked about, as opposed to kind of a regulatory scheme where the costs are borne by the property owner, it would force the agencies to start to establish priorities. And I think that's critical. I think if we were able to kind of identify, right, this is how much money we want to spend to protect species, then the agencies will have to, you know, prioritize what's the most important things to do. And I think, you know, that'd be better for the species and also for the taxpayer. But it's not just for the taxpayer. Look, this kind of idea that if you just do the same thing over again and over again, we'll get, you know, you're going to still get the bad results. So more money into this isn't necessarily the answer unless we want to spend more money, but we want to move away from this kind of heavy-handed regulation and the regulatory scheme that exists. If it means more money and then you get rid of the regulatory scheme and then you truly compensate property owners and come up with more of a voluntary approach, that might make sense. And that's something that should be looked into.
Ingrid, I'm curious as to something that Darren said. He brought up a point of that states have no say as far as the ESA is concerned. Should there be more of a cooperative effort between the federal agency and the states themselves to determine how the act is implemented?
Well, once a species is listed, the states certainly do play a role, and they already do. They work with the federal government to try to recover those species. And at Defenders of Wildlife, we have regional offices across the country, and we work with the state departments of natural resources quite a bit, both on species that are already listed and facing extinction and species that are imperiled and may be needing federal protections in the future. So the states play a tremendously important role. They already do that. And, you know, as far as states working to stave off federal protections under the Endangered Species Act, we think it would be great if the states stepped up and had best practices and played a big role in protecting species within their borders. But UC Irvine School of Law just did a survey of all the states looking at the measures that they already have available and the legal mechanisms they have available to protect species. And unfortunately, they came up short in many categories. And they also found that the states do not spend nearly enough money and not at commensurate levels with what the federal government spends on protecting species. So I think that it would be great to see progress, and, you know, they probably have funding problems of their own, but it would really be, we think states are great partners.
Darren.
The federal government is crowding out this whole issue. If you're a state and you see all these federal restrictions in place, and the federal government's not working with you collaboratively, and they're not listening to you, and the federal government's like, oh, we'll take care of it, or you can provide some input, maybe we'll listen to you. What is the incentive for states to be doing all kinds of innovative solutions and to spend more money on it? The federal government's crowding out the whole issue. When I say crowding out, they're discouraging states to be involved. And they're also discouraging property owners from being involved. Instead of having property owners and private citizens as partners through this process, the federal government and the property owners are kind of at odds with each other. They're enemies, and that's not going to achieve the objectives. Look, we want to recover species. What is the best way of doing that? It hasn't worked as well as it should. Let's figure out some solutions. And I think that should be the primary goal. I think we can all agree that we want the best outcomes. I don't think we've achieved those outcomes. And I think we can achieve a lot more if we work together, as opposed to just having the federal government decide how we're going to achieve these objectives, because it hasn't worked.
Ingrid, right now we have the ESA law that was enacted in 73. And the congressmen are calling for more or less consideration for economic standards to be included into the ESA Act. In other words, is there a way of accomplishing both, providing access for landowners, for people who have a stake in the properties, and at the same time, save the species? Is there a common sense compromise possible?
Well, when it comes to certain decisions like designating critical habitat, there already are those kinds of considerations and maybe, as you would say, compromises. But I think that the proposals we've seen from Congress aren't just to have economics play a little bit more of a role. The proposals are really far sweeping, and most of them seem to just aim at removing protections for species altogether. For example, there are bills in both chambers right now that would remove all protections for all foreign species under the Endangered Species Act. I don't see how that helps those species. Clearly, that's not one that's just aimed at economics, but that's an example of the very far-sweeping proposals that we see. Another one from Rand Paul would automatically delist every single species and then require congressional approval to re-grant protections for those species that the agencies already decided needed protections based on the science. And based on how much Congress achieves in a given legislative session, I don't understand how something like that could be workable.
Darren, you have the last word. Your response. Is there a way both can be served?
I think that if we simply, again, keep the listing process completely separate, and then any type of regulatory decision in the plans of how we're going to achieve the objectives, that does need to take into account the economics of it. You know, just because something might be listed doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't necessarily take action to protect that species. Would taking action actually achieve the objective? Are you going to be able to recover the species? What is the economic impact? What's the health and safety impact on humans? And what is the impact on other species that you might be able to actually help, but as a result of focusing on one species, you're actually undermining your ability to protect the species that actually could be helped? So one way we should start looking at this is almost like a triage type of situation, where you focus on the species where you can actually get the most benefit and actually start to move species off the list and start recovering them.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. My guests today were Ingrid Segerman, Senior Legislative Analyst of the Defenders of Wildlife, an advocacy organization that focuses on wildlife and habitat conservation in the United States, and Darren Baxt, Senior Research Fellow in Agriculture Policy at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative public policy think tank based here in Washington, D.C. I want to thank both of you for coming in today, talking with us, and providing us with such wonderful insights.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to thank Rebecca Ward for booking our guests for today's show and to our studio technician, Joe Gill. And thanks to you as well for taking time to listen to us today. Encounter was produced at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.